Hi, this is Jonathan Frakes, Commander William T. Riker from Star Trek The Next Generation, and you are listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
The Internet, the final frontier. These are the episodes of Comic Book Central, the ongoing mission to explore comic book movies and TV shows, to seek out creators of comic book adaptations, to boldly go where... Oh, forget it. That's been done already, and done a lot better. Welcome, one and all, to Comic Book Central. I'm your host, Joe Stuber, and as you can probably tell by that opening, we've got some amazing guests lined up for today, and I'm sure all of you Trekkers and Trekkies out there are really going to love this one. From Star Trek The Next Generation, Marina Sirtis and Jonathan Frakes are here today. Now, everyone knows Star Trek is a global phenomenon. 6 television series, including an animated show, and 12 motion pictures have kept the various Starfleet crews flying for over 46 years. In that time, just about every major comic book publisher has added to these interstellar adventures. Starting with Gold Key Comics and the original series, Star Trek's four-color adventures have warped through Marvel, Malibu, Wildstorm, and currently IDW. But in the 80s and 90s, DC Comics was the home of the Enterprise crews, both the original series and Star Trek The Next Generation. There are tons of great stories out there, and they're really affordable. So if you're a Trek fan, you got to get these books. Now, I'm a huge Star Trek fan, and just a few months ago, I was really stoked to find out Marina Sirtis, Counselor Deanna Troi herself, was making an appearance at the Steel City Con in Monroeville, Pennsylvania. It's just outside of Pittsburgh. Hey, it's one of my favorite conventions anyway. This was just added incentive for me to go. I had a chance to meet Marina there, and she was kind enough to sit down with me and talk Star Trek and some of the voiceover work she's been performing. Now, her schedule was way packed, so we didn't have a lot of time to talk, but we did have some fun chatting. Check this out first, and then my interview with Marina Sirtis. Born in London to Greek parents, Marina's exotic look and sound were the exact qualities Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry was looking for when casting for the crew of the Enterprise D. Roddenberry, however, did not have Marina in mind for the role of Deanna Troi. He was thinking more along the lines of security officer Maka Hernandez. Fortunately, that role was changed to Tasha Yar. Actress Denise Crosby joined the crew and led the security team, and Marina Sirtis was launched into stardom as the heart and soul of the crew, the half-betazoid, half-human empath, Deanna Troi. Welcome to the show, Marina Sirtis. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
When can we expect to see the J.J. Abrams-directed The Rikers?
Don't hold your breath. I would say is the short answer to that. It's not going to happen. We've gone with the younger new cast now. And
well, what a fantastic idea that would be. I mean, even if you did sort of a reality show,
I don't do reality.
Yeah, you and Jonathan Frakes together, they form a partnership. You guys have adventures together.
That would be great. Show. So we'd have to get Jonathan time off from directing because he's a big time director now.
He could never direct it in front and back. I mean, he could just do both parts.
Wouldn't that be great? We need a fan campaign. Inundate JJ with emails. There you go.
We'll start it now. Hey, since this is a comic book themed podcast, why don't we talk a little bit about your animation work, your voiceover work that you... It seems you're getting more into that now.
Well,
you started with Gargoyles back in the 90s, late 90s.
I can't remember when it was.
94 to 97.
Okay, thank you.
Demona.
Yes. They were fans of the show, of TNG. Which is why I think so many of us ended up on Gargoyles eventually.
A lot of Star Trek cast members ended up there.
Yeah.
Now, did your paths cross while you were doing it, or was it all just you in a studio?
No. The thing about Gargoyles, which was great, was we did it like a radio play. So everyone was in the studio at the same time.
Okay.
Which was fantastic. It's much more fun than sitting in a sound booth on your own.
You've done both?
I've done both, and I prefer the radio play concept.
Okay, well, I was going to ask, because you've also done voiceover work for Justice League.
Right.
Recently, Queen Bee.
Yes.
So for comic book fans, comic book enthusiasts.
We do,
love
but
that.
That's the same people that did Gargoyles, same director.
Now, what kind of energy, how are you able to work your energy differently when you're with a crew, you're playing off the actors? I mean, is that, for people wanting to get into voiceover work, how does that work for you?
Well, for me, it works better because for me, acting is reacting and listening. So if you've got actually someone saying the line like it's supposed to be said, then you can react to that appropriately. I think when you sit in the studio on your own, you've got the director reading the other lines to you, not an actor. And so basically you have to create a performance.
Well,
how
do you do
know.
That then?
You just do it and hope, and you know, you just hope for the best.
You run around the studio, get your energy up? Or
no,
how do you...
I don't run around. I'm not a method actress. I don't have to work up a sweat to act. But I just, you know, basically the thing that I find the most difficult is doing like the sound effects, you know, one of the...
Grunts.
Impact grunt is a very popular one on Gargoyles.
Okay.
It was.
Here's your direction. Give me an impact grunt. Give me three of them.
Right.
And how do you not feel silly doing that too?
Well, you do feel silly doing it, but everyone else is doing it too, so everyone feels silly doing it. But you know, the voice actors, I mean, I'm not a voice actor. I do accents. Voice actors do voices. I mean, we would have sometimes when we were doing Gargoyles, they'd say, we need one line. Scottish guy sounds like a dog, and three of the voice actors would put their hands up that they could do that, which I find incredible. I think they're so talented and so underrated into what they can do with their voices and all the different characters that they can do. I basically do me with different accents. So I have to be honest, voice acting is my least favorite form of acting, but it's, you know, it's fun. It's fun. And
you don't have to dress up.
And you can go in your pajamas and not wear makeup. Exactly.
You got to work along with Jonathan Frakes,
yes.
Your on-screen husband.
Yes.
Did he ever, since this is a comic book themed podcast, did he ever tell you about his secret background of going to conventions in the 70s dressed as a superhero?
He was Captain America.
Yes, he was.
I have
a picture here just in case
you
didn't.
That. We knew that, and we teased him mercilessly about that. Of course, he couldn't put that outfit on now. He's gained a couple of pounds, but I found it hysterical that he would dress up as Captain America and do personal appearances.
Let's segue into Star Trek then. In the beginning, how did you first come to the role of Deanna Troi? And it wasn't necessarily that role that you almost got, correct?
No, I was auditioning originally for Tasha Yar. And I think Denise was auditioning for Troi. I'm not sure about that. I actually have never asked her. But
Maka Hernandez?
She was supposed to be Marsha Hernandez.
Marsha,
or something like that.
Okay.
Or, you know.
How different would that have been?
Well, it just would have been a different name. You know, the reason that we were auditioning for each other's parts was because in the character description, Troi was supposed to be blonde and Tasha was supposed to be dark. And so we got sent in for each other's roles. But then when it came to the actual performance and the character, they realized they kind of got it wrong, and then it doesn't matter which one's blonde and which one's a brunette, so
and
they
perfect
switched
timing
me.
For you too.
Yes, I was leaving.
You were gone.
I was gone. I actually was offered the job on the day that I was leaving to go back to England.
Your visa
had run out. Well, my visa ran out the next day. I know. So for 3 weeks, I was an illegal immigrant. I was one of those illegal immigrants for 3 weeks. I know. I'm all right now because I'm a citizen. They can't throw me out. But
I guess it's probably an obvious question, but then how did Gene Roddenberry change your life?
Oh, goodness. Well, he changed my life by giving me that job, basically. My life in a day changed 180 degrees. And so I went from being an absolutely penniless British actress that no one had heard of to being in a pop cultural iconic TV series.
How crazy was that? And did you feel the pressure that first season? You're rebooting Legends.
Mm-hmm.
So did you feel that at the time, or
oh,
was it
yeah.
just like we'll do our best?
No, the fans were not happy that we were on. I mean, the fans were like really quite resentful sometimes.
My mother-in-law being one of them.
Yes, see? So they were very happy with their original show, and to watch it endlessly in reruns, they were not interested in a new Star Trek show. I think it took us pretty much about 3 years to win everybody over. Obviously not your mother-in-law, but everybody
she did.
Else.
Oh, she did.
Yeah, eventually.
Obsessed with Star Trek.
Eventually.
Yeah, you
yeah.
won her over.
But we did, it took a while to win them over. But yes, there was a pressure. Not so much when we were filming, when we started filming. It happened more coming into August because the show was going to premiere in September, and then we started getting all this attention. We had started shooting in June, so we had kind of 2.5 months of just filming and having fun, And then we realized that we were doing something that everyone was going to have an opinion about. And that's quite scary, because I had never done in my life anything that was going to get that much attention.
It worked out.
Thank goodness.
I had a picture, for the benefit of our listeners, I have a picture here, too, from one of my favorite episodes. It's called Disaster. You're familiar with it. Is this the first time Troy took the captain's chair?
It was. I think the one and only time Troy took the captain's chair.
On TV?
Yeah.
This one ended better than the theatrical version of Troy taking...
No, I didn't take the captain's chair. I took the helm and crashed
the
ship
and, right.
twice. You know, I have to be honest.
What does that say?
Let me just say this. That planet came out of nowhere, okay? Not my fault.
It was in a blind spot?
You know, it was. It just kept, you know, from nowhere, suddenly there's this planet, and I can't avoid it. And that no one told me where the brakes were.
Talking about comic books, too, on this, DC Comics had a huge run with Star Trek The Next Generation, a lot of different Star Trek. How does that come to you with likeness rights and things? I mean, do you have to deal with that stuff or
not
somebody else?
No, not the comic book stuff. I don't have that power to approve my likeness.
Because
in a comic
comics
book.
Are dead on, the images.
The comics are dead on. The other merchandising, not so much. The dolls. I don't think they've ever got it right with me, with the doll, with one of the action figures. We look like we might be related, but it doesn't really look like me. But the comic books do a much better job, yes.
Wrap us up a little bit here. Any thoughts at all about cameos in the current Star Trek?
Listen,
Has anybody talked to you?
No, no one's talked to me about it. Of course, I would love to be in one of the new movies. I think it would be great. Purely because I just love Star Trek now, you know, so to still be involved in it in some way would be fantastic. But if it doesn't happen, I've had a pretty good run.
Have we seen the last of Deanna Troi?
I think we have.
What about an animated series? We could do an animated series.
I can't do it. Paramount would have to do it, or CBS, who owns Paramount now. I think I pretty much have to. It's been a long time since our show went off the air. I think we have to accept now that it's behind us and move on to other things. And like I said, we had a really good run.
You played an empath for the better part of 18 years. What am I feeling right now?
Don't make me slap you.
I was going to say gratitude. I was going to say immense gratitude for having you join us on the show
today.
Well,
thank you. And I was thinking
something
totally
different.
You've been
at comic book conventions too long.
I have. I was thinking it was going to be something smutty.
I'll give you another shot. What am I thinking?
It's time for me to wrap up.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
For being on the show today.
Thank you.
Al, my bad. I should have guessed all those years of getting hit on by Star Trek fans have taken their toll. Poor Marina Sirtis. You know, I was just trying a clever way to say thanks, and all those nervous fanboys that hit on her, they seem to have ruined the experience. But fear not, Marina Sirtis. Some of us just want to express our appreciation for your time and talent. Well, hopefully Marina's on-screen husband, Jonathan Frakes, doesn't think I'm a creepy stalker. That said, I did kind of nerd out when I first met Jonathan way back in April of 1993. It was one of my first gigs in television. I was interning at a local station as a videographer. It was myself, fellow intern Joe Willard, and reporter Ryan Brandt. We hit the road to State College, Pennsylvania to interview Jonathan. He was appearing at Schwab Auditorium in the Concert for Peace. Now, here's a blast from the past. This clip hasn't been heard anywhere in over 20 years.
On Star Trek The Next Generation, Jonathan Frakes as Commander William Riker goes where no one has gone before.
Mr. Worf. Fire.
But today the actor returned to a familiar place, the Penn State campus. Born in Bellefonte and raised in Bethlehem, the 1974 PSU grad will be a guest performer in the Concert for Peace Saturday at 8 p.m. in Schwab Auditorium.
Jonathan and I have been trying to do this work together for a couple of years, and finally this year we're really pleased our schedule's meshed, and he's here to be our guest performer tomorrow night.
Inside the Arts Building is where Jonathan Frakes served his first tour of duty before beaming aboard the Enterprise, and he said that returning to his alma mater and seeing that old building has brought back a lot of memories.
I walked back into this Arts Building where I used to rehearse and do plays, and I felt as if I'd gone back 20 years. I felt like a student again. I felt like I should go down and check to see if I'd been cast in the next production. I was hoping I wasn't late for class.
Not only is Frakes an established actor, but he's now becoming a respected director, having directed some episodes of The Next Generation.
What's your favorite episode you've directed?
I still have a soft spot for the first one. It's about Data's daughter, lovely Lal, Hallie Todd.
What about the Drumhead?
Drumhead was great. Gene Simmons. We were privileged to have a woman, an actress of that caliber, an Oscar nominee. And when she said, "I brought down bigger men than you, Picard," all of us roared.
"I will expose you for what you are. I brought down bigger men than you, Picard."
Talk about a local boy making good. Playmates has come out with a line of Star Trek action figures, including Commander Riker himself.
That's the most absurd part of all. A little action figure. So I see my friends drowning in the bathtubs.
What's next for Frakes? Well, he hopes to get into more directing, and through his success on Star Trek, the future appears awfully bright. In University Park, I'm Ryan Brandt, NewsWatch.
Yeah, when I met him, honestly, I went full nerd with my Star Trek t-shirt. I didn't even have a Next Generation t-shirt. I just had my Star Trek VI t-shirt. I also had my Commander Riker action figure. Honestly, I don't regret any of it for a second, though. I got to talk Trek with the big guy. He signed my Riker toy, and I have it right here in the lair. And as you heard in the clip, Jonathan was hoping for more directing gigs. And man, did he get them. The most recent of which is the Thor: The Dark World crossover episode on Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. We'll talk about that episode, also that mysterious teaser scene about Tahiti that he directed. Of course, we'll talk Star Trek and also Jonathan's voiceover work with his Star Trek castmates. Just a quick note, as you heard in the clip, Jonathan was born in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania. He was raised in Bethlehem, graduated from Penn State. So the subject of the university does come up briefly. There are obviously a lot of raw emotions over what took place at Penn State, and I wanted to make sure that I included this part of the conversation in the interview, just to give an insider's perspective on the feelings and issues that are still being resolved, that are still going to be resolved in the years to come. Jonathan and I talk about a lot in this interview. So let's get right to it. Here is my conversation with Jonathan Frakes. Well, joining me today is someone well-known to Trekkers and Trekkies alike, but he's now recognized as an accomplished director. And he's part of the Marvel Universe. Jonathan Frakes, thank you for joining me here today on Comic Book Central.
The pleasure is mine, Joe.
Hey, we talked a little bit about this now, this Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. You're now directed one of these episodes.
I did the Thor tie-in episode where we found Asgardian remnants in three parts of the world. I'm waiting to see if I get another Marvel assignment as the show has been picked up for the back half of the season.
Yeah, it's called The Well, and you mentioned, it's coming right out of Thor: The Dark World. Did you know at the time that you were given the assignment to direct this that this was going to be part of the Marvel movie universe?
Yes, that was part of the plan. It was a November sweeps episode, and they had permission from Marvel, as obviously they would, because Marvel produces the show, to use clips from the trailer and everything except anybody's face.
I noticed that. Yeah, the Shavor came
Chris
in.
Hemsworth from the chest down.
His CGI part, right?
Yeah, we saw all of his feet.
That's classic. So now I know everything in the Marvel universe is kept super secret. I know all these. So I'm going to keep this to a yes or no question. Do you know why Tahiti is such a magical place?
Yes.
Ah. Okay. I'm curious as to when you're directing these projects, because obviously the little post-credit scene we have there, we have Agent Coulson, and we see him in Tahiti finally.
Getting a massage,
yeah. He fell asleep.
What about the dollhouse throwback?
Yeah. Well, tell us what you know about just directing your part of it. What do you know about that whole sort of mystery that's going on, and how did you
I can't tell you anything.
I tried.
I'd have to give up one of my children. When you work at Marvel, when you work on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., as a guest director, you're not even given a card key to get into the building. You have to buzz the door, and you're the director of the show.
You're checked in at the gate.
You can barely get in the gate, but when you get into the offices, the writers and the producers have little magnetic IDs, wow, like a retinal scan. And as a guest director, you're not even given one because you may steal some of the ideas.
It's like S.H.I.E.L.D. I mean, it's like you're going into S.H.I.E.L.D.
It's astounding.
Wow. So okay.
Trek used to be like that. We used to take ourselves that seriously.
How many years into the show till they finally said, ah?
I think it was mostly the movies. That, okay. You know, watermarked scripts and un-Xeroxable or reproducible pages in colors that would not scan. It was a riot.
Well, especially when you're dealing with things like the Borg and some of those, you know, those high-end concepts that Trek was famous for. So when you're directing S.H.I.E.L.D. then, okay, so do we know, will we get the resolution this season, or is this something we're going to have to wait 5 years for, like, you know, Lost?
On Tahiti, you mean?
Yeah.
That's a good question. That I don't know the answer to.
Okay.
I was just given a tease when I was trying to figure out what this scene was teeing up.
Well, I was wondering about that, because as a director, are you saying, okay...
We have to know something about it.
Yeah, he's on the table. What am I doing? Why is he getting a massage?
You know? Yeah, so they were as vague as they could be. But if you look closely at the scene, there is a beaker on the table where you would find a glass. I'll give you that as a little Easter egg.
Thank you very much. Oh, well, we appreciate that. Well, let's see, we're getting a little bit of information here on Comic Book Central
there
today.
There you go.
Well, okay, but this isn't the first time you were in the Marvel Universe. We're coming full circle here. One of your early roles was as the Star-Spangled Avenger, Captain America.
Wow, you've done a little research, haven't you?
Well, it is Comic Book Central. That's what we do here, so I would not be doing my duty if I didn't.
In the late 70s, I used to go over to 575 Madison Avenue with my friend Charlie Davis, who played Spider-Man. We'd sign out our costumes, including my garbage can lid shield and plastic clip-on Captain America wings, and we'd go to open comic book stores and 7-Elevens in different parts of the great middle America.
And the White House as well, too, right?
Well, the White House was the best of the gigs. That was the Rosalind and Amy Carter environmental lawn party. That's Stan was there, and the Hulk, and that was the peak of my Captain America experiences. The 7-Elevens in Omaha were the other end of the spectrum.
That wasn't the
riding
like the
in on the
family.
Front. Well, you ride in on the front of a rented Taurus, driven by a Andy Frame rental security guard, and you bounce up into this sad little parking lot with your garbage can lid held valiantly in front of you.
You gave it your all, though. As an actor, you got to commit, right?
You had to commit.
Yeah, and the great part is your face is covered.
And the great part is we made $50 a day.
What more can you want? You get to play Cap, and you get to make $50 a day. You know, we spoke to Marina Sirtis. She said that she and the rest of the cast teased you mercilessly regarding this Captain America assignment. What did they do to you on set?
She had no idea I played Captain America. She was lying to you.
No, she absolutely didn't, because I mentioned it to her in the interview, and before I even said anything, she says, yep, he played Captain America. She knew it before I even mentioned it.
No, she didn't.
Absolutely. Well,
she's an actress, man. She's an actress.
She definitely is a telepath.
Well, that we know. That, I got to tell you, is she's a telepath and a psychic and a Betazoid.
Well, then she's that in real life. So, well, you're going to have to listen to this episode of Comic Book Central to find out a little bit about that. So they didn't. There was no teasing on the set about Captain America?
Not to my recollection.
Maybe it was all behind your back.
That would be even more attractive.
That I can imagine. So, well, you know, you're from Eastern Pennsylvania. I'm from Western Pennsylvania. Beautiful state. You went to Penn State originally. Do you get to go back there much?
I do. My mom's still in Bethlehem, so I go see her a couple times a year at least. I just spoke to her on the phone this morning. Yeah, it is a gorgeous state. Unfortunately, one man has single-handedly taken down my alma mater in terms of our reputation.
Yeah, unfortunately. 9/11. Well, what did you think about that when that whole thing was going down, from your perspective?
I'm still reeling with I used to be so proud to be from Penn State and so proud to have been able to do what I do and come from this big state school where my dad taught, where I was born, where my dad got his bachelor's, where I spent two of my high school years. Everything about it was a source of pride for me, and that one day, I've been apologizing since. So it gutted me.
Can they bounce back?
not for generations, I don't think.
Yeah. What do you think people can do in that area to sort of kind of bounce back from this, or at least not feel so emotionally crushed by what's happened? Because obviously, as you said, this is going to take some time.
I'm not sure. I think it is. I think time heals everything, but there's. Oh God, it's such a raw and fraught and dangerous topic to discuss at any length. We don't know who's culpable. I certainly think that defending Joe Pa just because he was Joe Pa is nonsense. There's and the poor man's dead, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there was so much fallout in such a short period of time. It just seemed like everything collapsed and crumbled all at once. So,
Well, it did feel like an incredibly elaborate either cover-up or turn the other cheek to something that's unspeakably heinous. So it guts me. A friend of mine that I went to Penn State with is a lawyer who's working on the case who lives in Philly now, and we discuss it on a sort of regular basis, and it ruined our memory, and so we are two of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who were affected by this.
Yeah, it was unbelievable just kind of seeing all this take place, you know. And again, it just was such a short window that everything just collapsed. So I think that's part of the problem too, is that people just couldn't prepare themselves for it, for the emotional aspect of it. But
no.
Like you said,
and also the school is now sullied in the world, in the lexicon. It's like being a Muslim, you know.
Well, it's a punchline.
Muslim, some of the, you know, the Muslim radicals are a tiny little percent of them.
Yeah. Anyway, it's unfortunate. We're getting too down here. But like you said, hopefully time will heal all wounds. Hopefully that'll be the case. But on to more pleasant matters. You've got one of the best Hollywood marriages around. How many years now?
We've been together for 28 years, married for 25.
The lovely Jeannie Francis.
She's sitting outside having her coffee. Yeah, she's amazing. Absolutely amazing. And talented Jeannie Francis.
Where did you first meet?
We met in a series called Bare Essence back in 82, something like that, which was a short-lived nighttime soap that she was starring in with Linda Evans and Ian McShane and Donna Mills and John Daner and Boxleitner and then it was a miniseries, then it was a series on CBS. And then a few years later, the same producer cast us in the Civil War epic, North and South.
Yeah, the miniseries.
The miniseries. And that went on for the better part of a year. We were on the road. And during that year, I used to bring her Diet Cokes and flirt with her. And finally, she relented and allowed me to take her to dinner.
You wore her down
in Charleston. I did.
Yeah. Well, that's incredible. What's the secret to sustaining a marriage in Hollywood?
Jeannie was asked that question the other day on The View when she was they were celebrating the 50th anniversary of General Hospital. So I'll steal her answer, which was, "You got to be willing to put up with a few shitty years."
I've always been told, you know, a successful marriage is the union of two forgivers.
Oh, man.
You know, so I can totally understand that. Yeah. Look, you're going to hit some rough patches, right?
All right. Are you married?
I am, yes.
There you go.
Coming up on 20 years. So, yeah, you can't just cash in the chips when things get tough.
Exactly.
And that wasn't the only project that you got to star with her. And this something special to something near and dear to our hearts on Comic Book Central, Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman. Tim
that
and Amber
was a
Lake.
Blast. We played the Trumps.
Basically, yeah. The evil.
The evil Trump family who we were buying up relics, as I recall. That was we had a wonderful time. Our son Jameson was practically a newborn, so he went to work with us, and I've been able to work with her since. We did Lois and Clark together, and we did this very interesting show on current TV called Bar Karma, which unfortunately no one ever saw, which she was fabulous in, that I directed her in.
Well, how entertaining is that to be able to work with your wife, and especially in a role like the one on Lois and Clark, where you are married on the set, and then you're given so much scenery to chew at the same time, because these are like way over the top villains.
Oh, my God. Big hair, big clothes.
Big shoulder pads. Yeah.
Big shoulder pads, right.
How fun was that? Because you play, just so our listeners know if they haven't seen the episode, you play, like as you mentioned, the evil version of the Trumps, but you collect all these crazy things. Do you remember what some of the things were that you collected?
I know we had the Batmobile, and we were going for Superman's cape at the moment.
Yeah, there was Jimmy Hoffa was in your collection. The Arms of Venus de Milo.
Have you rewatched this episode?
The Magna Carta. Yes, I have, in all fairness. But, yeah, and you hired Bad Brain Johnson. You sprung him from prison, and then you killed him.
Of course.
Of course you did. You wiped him out. So this was actually a very cool episode of Lois and Clark because you had, like, all these spoofs. They were worried about being married or talking about marriage. So you had an I Love Lucy spoof. You had the James Bond spoof, the Dragnet spoof. So this was really – there's a ton of layers to this episode. How fun was it for you
I'm
guys?
I'm actually going to work with – I'm doing a show in February with Dean Cain again, Superman. Oh,
fantastic. That's one of the standout episodes, so you guys have something to talk about there as well. So how fun was that to just work with Jeannie and just go over the top with it?
It was wonderful. It was great to go to work together anyway.
One of your other projects, famous to the comic book world, Gargoyles. You got to do some voiceover acting with some of your Star Trek alum.
Some. It was like a Star Trek reunion show.
It was. Like everybody was on this thing.
I love Gargoyles. I think it might have been too smart for television.
Well, your character, David Xanatos, he looks like you.
I know it. That was bizarre. When I first got hired, they showed us the artwork, and it seemed somewhat ironic that he had a well-trimmed beard.
Yeah, he's kind of like he's the CEO of his company, and I kind of picture him as like a Lex Luthor of the Gargoyles.
That's what
universe.
I was going to say. He's very Lex Luthor, very sort of evil den of evil guy.
Yeah, but like well-trained, like martial arts, just like, I mean, you don't want to mess with him.
Not Xanatos.
Did you get a chance to work directly with the other Star Trek actors, or were you just sort of off in a booth doing your thing?
In most cases on that show, we actually went to work together, where we'd sit in a semicircle and eat bagels. And the wonderful Jamie was our director who does all the Disney movies. And it was unlike Family Guy, where we recorded our parts individually because we were spread out all over the world at that point. There's something wonderful about being in the room with the actors that you're playing the scenes with.
What does that do for your performance?
Well, you get to do it like a radio play, sort of like you and I.
There you go. And you can kind of amp it up, too. Are you really getting into it and, you know, arms flailing? And when we talked to Maria Sirtis, she was like,
You've seen all the backstage stuff of, you know, Robin Williams and John Lithgow, and you see how they behave. That's exactly what it's like, as long as you don't rustle your clothes too much.
Don't hit the mic. Yeah, exactly. What advice do you have for people trying to break into voiceover acting?
I'm still trying. That's a great racket, and if I could do more of it, I would.
Go to work in sweats and T-shirt. And
oh, what a dream. What about the people in The Simpsons?
They've turned that into, a little enterprise there, haven't they?
Wow. Yes,
and they get to renegotiate all the time to up their salaries, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I got a little bit of envy.
You need to talk to Seth MacFarlane, I guess. Get one of these leads in an animated series, right?
You got it.
All right, Star Trek The Next Generation. Let's get to this. How did you land the part of Commander William Riker, one of the most iconic characters in television history?
Well, I've told this story many times. I auditioned 7 times over a 6-week period. And they finally relented after they decided they weren't going to use Billy Campbell, who I think was their front runner. And Roddenberry was amazing during that period. He took me under his wing as the great space bird of the galaxy and virtually convinced me that the 24th century would be a time of great hope and that Riker would be a leader in that period, and he was inspirational in a way that many others have not been. So I was very fortunate to be in that place at that time.
obviously he was much more involved in the original Trek series and then probably the first couple of seasons of Next Generation. So how did he impact your performance as Riker, or did he impact your performance as Riker?
Well, I think he had a vision of Riker that was sadly not who I was. He wanted Riker to be very stoic. He always described him as having a non-smiling Midwestern Gary Cooper carriage, which was never part of who I was. So gradually he let Frakes play Riker instead of his idea of who should play Riker.
How did your personality start to take over Riker's? Do you remember, was there just was it a certain season? Was there a certain
episode? I remember very specifically Morris Hurley, who was one of Rick Berman's exec producers in the early, I think it may have been during the first season, took me to lunch and took me to the racetrack, and we talked and talked and talked. And from those meetings, he gleaned that I played the trombone, that I liked jazz, and gradually the elements that he saw in me, he wrote into Riker, and the character became much more comfortable.
How was that for you as an actor to finally be able to bring some of yourself to the role? Because obviously those first seasons, or the first season, yeah, it was very straightforward.
Very stiff. Yeah. Very, very stiff. Physically, emotionally. I mean, we were all stiff because not all of us are stiff. I was stiff. But we were just finding out who we were in relation to each other as characters and in relation to each other as friends and in relation to each other as actors. So by the second, third season, we really found our legs, and I think the show reflected it. I think the quality of the episodes, both in front of and behind the camera, they just got more and more interesting and more layered. And it's like so many things. It's a matter of being together and working together. We were also blessed, as you've heard, I'm sure, from everybody you've talked to from the show, that we were one of those groups that actually were like a family. We not only worked 80 hours a week, we'd go to dinner together on Saturday, and we'd go out on Friday nights. We stood up at each other's weddings. We were godparents to each other's kids. We still see each other all the time. So it was lightning in a bottle, as Laura used to say.
Did you get a sense when you first got the role, and the rest of the cast members as well, did you feel that sort of overwhelming sense of, wow, we got to pick up the ball and run with this? Or did you just approach it as, look, this is a gig, we got to abandon all that and just go with it?
The second. We saw it as it was just a gig. At least I didn't have, the only real Trekkers on the show, I think, were Dorn and Will. So the rest of us were kind of clueless as to the popular, cultural, iconic status that Star Trek had. I mean, we found out pretty fast that the audience, for instance, for the classic Trek was very skeptical of our existence. And as a result, and Paramount as well, there were three contracts. We had a contract to do the pilot, a contract to do the first 13, and then if it should happen to go well, they would pick us up for a season and then beyond. So it was a very interesting time. It was the first scripted television show ever made directly for syndication. So they had a cunning financial plan where they wouldn't take too bad a beating if it didn't work. It was, an Englishman playing a Frenchman as opposed to the swashbuckling William Shatner. There was no Vulcans. It was a risky business that they'd been trying to get Roddenberry to do for many, many years, by all reports. And when he relented and wrote this show, and it was never a network show anyway, so he didn't want it to be on the network because he wanted to have a little more artistic freedom. It was an interesting time to be around, and as I find out more and more about the what was going on in the administration part of Paramount, the people were very clever how they controlled this show.
Do you think that was calculated too at the beginning to just make it completely different than the original series? I mean, obviously you had a couple of episodes that were similar in theme in the first season, but do you think that was calculated right off the top that we've got to go in a completely different direction?
Absolutely. I think that was that was probably their number one, if you pardon the expression, concern.
You mind if we do a little free association with some of your cast members?
Oh, of course.
Of course you mind, or of course it's okay?
No, of course I'd be happy to.
Got to check that for a second there. All right, let's do a little free association. Will Wheaton.
The wonderful Will Wheaton. The character took a huge beating when he was playing Wesley Crusher. And he is now, when we do our convention circuits, he is the spokesperson who is the most articulate about that period and the most emotionally connected and expresses himself the most clearly to the fans. I value him as a friend, and I'm a huge fan, and I wish I had his Twitter following.
Denise Crosby.
Pookie Yar. Denise Crosby stole my pink chenille bathrobe, which I wore to makeup trailer for all of the first season. And when she left the show, not only did our characters cry, but we all wept as well. She's one of my favorites and a great dancer.
Gates McFadden.
The brilliant and talented. I just saw Gates do a production of a show that Brent Spiner played Frank Sinatra in. Another wonderful dancer and one of the most beautiful women in the planet and a dear friend.
Michael Dorn.
Chadich. My Klingon brother, who takes me out for vegan lunches every second week. My partner in crime and one of my closest friends.
LeVar Burton.
Birdie is my ally. I have been through many, many, many events on and off camera with LeVar that I hold near and dear to my heart. He is, whenever we talk to each other, we call each other ally as well. So he's a very special man, as you probably have heard. Have you talked to LeVar?
Not yet, no.
Yeah, he
would very much like to have him on the show, though.
Yeah, he's as we say, we like to we cobble together our careers now so that we have enough money to put our kids through college.
Brent Spiner.
Oh, Data is my favorite. Brent Spiner is arguably one of the most talented and probably the funniest member of our entire company. I have had the privilege of working with him on other shows as well, and he brings it to whatever he does. Brilliant singer, incredible intellect, dry wit, worldly Renaissance man, and a sweetheart.
You were also on his album, correct?
On Old Yellow Eyes is back. All the boys did.
So, yeah, again, once again, Commander Riker's musical talents on display. Patrick Stewart.
Oh, I just sent him an email. He opens tonight on Broadway with Sir Ian McKellen. So I tweeted out and I sent him an email. I talked to him last week. He and I, from the moment we met, he felt like a big brother to me. We started talking about cricket and baseball, and I was just at his wedding as well. I adore him. I mean, his talent is unquestionable, but his heart is even bigger. And also a wicked sense of humor that some people don't get to see.
What's going on with him these days? There's, like, these videos being posted, and he's just, like, becoming a little kid
again.
He's
wild.
Have you talked to him about it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What do you like? Just what's up?
He's living the life. He's 72 going on 30. And he is, he's doing Pinter's No Man's Land and Beckett's Godot on Broadway with Sir Ian McKellen. He's married to this wonderful Sonny Ozel, who's a singer from Brooklyn. He's physically in his prime. He's doing great.
Do you think he and Ian McKellen are becoming the modern-day odd couple? It seems like They're everywhere these
days. It certainly feels that way. I gather the Godot that they did on the West End was described as the best of the century, or maybe the best ever. So I'm glad to see that they're revisiting that. And McKellen performed the wedding ceremony at Patrick and Sonny's wedding last month.
I'd love to see them as the odd couple. That would actually be kind of a cool gig.
Yeah, they could reverse roles night after night.
Right, right. Yeah, well, yeah, there's a lot of actors that do that, that just kind of keep it fresh. So, yeah, that would be very cool. Finally, Marina Sirtis.
Oh, my anxiety. She was the glue. She was the... she's a dear friend of my wife's as well, so we still see quite a bit of her. She's the soul. She's a lot like Counselor Troy, and I spend a lot of time at the conventions with her. We always go on stage together. She's one of my dearest friends and one of our dearest family friends, and incredibly underused talent in terms of other work. But I think she's the head of the Hassad on the NCIS as we speak. But she's got a very deep and generous soul.
I'd love to see the Rikers. I mentioned it to Maria.
Well, we've been pitching the Rikers in space for about 15 years at the conventions.
I said, have you ever hit J.J. Abrams up with it? She says, nah, we haven't done that. But you never know. A little ancillary Star Trek project?
I think it would be brilliant. CBS, unfortunately, who owns Star Trek now, is not interested in any Star Trek television projects, what I've been told.
Well, there's always those rumors going around since the movies are kind of blowing up on the big screen now. There's like, hey, can we do this on television again? There's always things that are kicked around. Star Trek Titan is always brought up, some of these different things. I mean,
I tried to take a project to Paramount, and they said, listen, we've already turned down Brian Singer and William Shatner, so don't waste your time. So it's unless things have changed, I think they have rethought the... what do we call that? The business plan that buried us originally, where Paramount's greed.
Too many shows.
Oh, please. Voyager, Enterprise, Nemesis, movies coming out when there's already television on the air. It was just ludicrous. And then they shut down. JJ takes the reins and opens huge and then repeats it with another fantastic movie. So I think they have, in terms of business, I think they're doing it the right way. Unfortunately, it cuts us out of television.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all those projects, though, did give you an opportunity to direct a little bit more and to feature Commander Riker in a couple different series, though. So I think, are you the, next to Majel Barrett, the actor that's been on the most series with Star Trek?
I think Armin and myself...
Yeah, you were on all of them. Obviously, not the original series, but you were on all of them, and you got a chance to direct. When did you first get the directing bug on Star Trek? When did you first go? Oh,
very early on,
the other side.
When I found myself sitting around in my little room waiting, I realized that I needed to be a little more active than this, and the opportunity was so clearly teed up by virtue of being on a show. We used to do 26 episodes a year, which nobody does anymore. So we were around directors and around the show for over 10 months of the year.
How tough is that to direct yourself in the scenes? So we've talked about this with some actors who are also directors as well. How do you turn one brain off and turn the other one on at the same time?
It's easier if it's a part that you've been playing. I mean, by the time Berman finally relented and let me have an episode, I'd been playing Riker for 3 years. So... I was pretty familiar, pretty comfortable in his clothes. To direct yourself in a new project is, I think, daunting. To direct yourself in a character that you are comfortable with, and if you have people around you that you trusted, I had Patrick and LeVar, and when I was doing the movies, I'd look over the camera at Matt Leonetti. There were certain people who I would make eye contact with after a take, and they would let me know if they thought I needed to go again, or if I thought I had it, if I questioned it, I would just immediately go and do another take. But there were always litmus tests on the set that I could access and use as a taste meter.
Favorite episodes, favorite guest stars that you had over the years?
Best of Both Worlds, I think, was the best television that we made, that cliffhanger that carried over, I think, between seasons 3 and 4.
You had the greatest ending on a cliffhanger, Riker.
Oh, fire.
That shot, too, the angle.
Yeah, it was spectacular.
Give me a break.
I have a real soft spot for The Offspring, which is the first one that I directed, in which Brent built his daughter, beautiful Hallie Todd.
As Lala.
We'd be crazy not to mention Delancey, who was a huge part of the Star Trek family and probably our greatest nemesis and not really a guest star, more of a recurring regular.
Was there ever a thought
Armin and Colum and, yeah, it was a very special place to be.
Was there ever a thought to bring the character of Q onto the big screen?
Because obviously I was involved with the movie franchise, I thought that was a kind of a no-brainer, and Paramount didn't think that the scale of his villainy was big enough for the movies, if I recall correctly, what their excuse for. I mean, obviously the Borg were a wonderful, wonderful villain. But, for instance, the story in Insurrection certainly could have used a Q somewhere in the mix.
Yeah, I always thought that was a character that was just begging for life on the big screen, because the scope of what he could accomplish is incredible. We talked about this, you and I, off air. You and I first met. I'm sure it's completely locked into your memory banks at this point. Back in
Schwab Auditorium, Penn State University. Concert for Peace, 1994.
You remember.
See, you were a young pup from the Johnstown television station doing an interview. Shaking with your mic. You had your Star Trek action figure with you. I signed it with a Sharpie, and you still have it on your shelf.
Yes, those are all true. You remember. I know. You think about this every day, of course. People listening right now are like, did he really remember? Wow, that's incredible. You know what? In all honesty, I came up to you in full nerd gear, and you know, I apologize for that. Somebody was, I had the shirt on. But you know what was funny about that was you looked at it, and you were like, oh, you got a Star Trek shirt on. And you're like, oh, that's from one of the features. Complete tongue-in-cheek. I had my Star Trek VI shirt on. I didn't have a Next Generation shirt on. What's interesting is now you have two of those features directed on your resume.
Unbelievable.
At that time, did you even think... Was that a plan at the time to just, you know, I'd love to just take the reins and direct this cast on the big screen?
It was a dream, but I didn't think it was a dream that would come true. I mean, I assumed that when we went to the features that they'd bring in... Well, I mean, to be honest, they offered the movies to big A-list feature action adventure directors who didn't want to do Star Trek 8 or whatever that was. So when it got down to the B-list, I was able to throw my own hat in the ring, and Sherry Lansing, who ran Paramount at the time, allegedly said to Berman, who was producing the films as well as the TV show, he said, you know, you get who you want to have do it, and it worked out.
Oh, you knocked it out of the park. I mean, that was, I think...
Well, it was, you know...
Next to Star Trek IV, the biggest
one. Brilliant.
Yeah.
It was my job to keep it on course. The script was spectacular for First Contact.
Did you know at the time you were making it? Because obviously you've got Zefram Cochrane, you've got the Borg, you've got the first solo adventures of the Next Generation crew. Did you guys kind of know when you were putting this together that, hey, this is probably going to be pretty big?
Yes, that I can say. We knew that was a great movie. That was ours to not screw up. And then when we were lucky enough to get Alfre Woodard and Jamie Cromwell and Alice Krieger, it was just, it took it to another level.
Nerves come in with taking the feature reins at that time, or were you just so comfortable and relaxed with this crew that you were like, yeah, it's...
Both. Both, actually.
Did the nerves serve to help you?
I think they always do. My daughter just was doing Midsummer Night's Dream, and she was playing Helena, and she said, I'm nervous. And I said, well, if you're not nervous, and it's, you know, something's not right. It's part of the package.
How did the cast respond to your direction, do you feel?
I think there was a shorthand that we had. I mean, once they, you know, they took the piss out of me when I started directing the episodes, and they were hysterical, you know. But that's just because that's how we treated each other. But by the time we had done a lot of these together, I think, without sounding too arrogant, I think they trusted me.
Did you get advice from any of the other directors, like Leonard Nimoy had directed?
Actually, I did get very good advice from Nimoy, who was very helpful to me, and Bob Justman, who was one of the producers from the original show, who was on our show as well, always said, you never go on the set without your shot list. And I thought, what a great piece of advice. And to this day, before I go to bed, I have my little shot list written out. I put it on my call sheet, I put it on my script. And when I get up at 5 or 6 or wherever in the morning and go in, I always think, yep, if all else fails, I've got my shot list.
Well, it's a grocery list. I mean, you don't want to forget anything.
Exactly.
What advice did Nimoy give you?
Nimoy said, always stay on the story. Don't forget the emotional beats in the story. Don't get caught up in the visual effects. And it's very, very true. I mean, his was one of my favorites, the one about the one with the whales in San Francisco. I thought was one of the great Star Trek movies.
Well, you see, you take that advice because there's a scene in First Contact where Zefram Cochrane's getting drunk. Marina Sirtis is there as Troy. And you've got this great scene where you walk up. I mean, how awesome was that? And then that look you make at the end of the it's just
that was a simple and wonderful scene.
But it's a perfect beat for the movie in this special effects-filled extravaganza. Those are the moments, I think, that live on.
Well, that and the scene with Alfrey and Patrick in the in the conference room where he breaks the and you know his little ships. it's those the acting moments were the ones that certainly I remember the most fondly, as opposed to the visual effects, with the exception, of course, of the brilliant John Knoll and the visual effect of Alice Krieger connecting her spine to her the rest of her body.
That is a crazy scene. That is a crazy scene. It's a perfect movie. It's a perfect movie, so good on you. Very good job on that. What advice do you have for actors who find themselves in these genre roles that are kind of worried about typecasting? You easily could have been pigeonholed into this and have been Commander Riker for the rest of your life.
Have been. Not could have been, have been.
Do you feel that you've been typecast?
I don't feel I've been typecast. I have been typecast. I can't get a job as an actor. I'm very thankful to have learned another craft.
Well, that's what I was getting at, how do you kind of, is that
well,
the advice
that you
give to...
Well, another thing Nimoy said was it's better to be typecast than not to be cast at all. Because, you know, Patrick's an exception. Patrick has certainly never stopped. Shatner's an exception, but...
What's the secret? Does Patrick tell you what he's done, or is it just, hey,
no,
whatever happens?
Patrick was Patrick before Picard, and he was determined to continue his stage work, and that has led to and to another franchise. I mean, he's got the X-Men franchise.
Yeah.
So maybe that's one of the reasons Patrick's making those YouTube videos. He's a happy man.
Well, you're directing Marvel projects. He's starring in Marvel projects. Is that a possibility down the road that you might be able to direct your former castmate in one of these Marvel films? What would you pick?
Why don't you put that out in the ether?
It's out there right now. So there's a ton of Marvel projects. The whole universe is Guardians of the Galaxy is coming up. What would you like to take on? Captain America 3. You could come full circle.
I would love to do Captain America. There's a new one coming out, I think, in February. When's the next Captain America?
Yep, new one coming out in the spring, and then I'm sure he signed for a trilogy, so I'm sure we've got another one coming up. Which Marvel or DC? You know, we've got Man of Steel, we've got all these things coming up. What would you like to just direct or have a role in, or which one stands out for you?
I'd like to do a small indie in Paris where people smoke cigarettes and drive cars. And
you don't want the big production, just a small indie film?
Yeah. Can you arrange that?
Well, sure, but I'd love to see you take on one of these Marvel projects. I think you would bring a depth to it that might be lacking in some comic book films.
I'm developing a wonderful action fantasy trilogy called Alosha that ironically named Christopher Pike from his novels. That we're developing with Weta, with Peter Jackson's company, with Sir Richard Taylor.
Wow.
And those would be huge.
What's your role in it? Are you writing it? Or are you planning on directing
and producing?
Okay.
I'm directing with a producer named Rudy Longley, who did Hurricane.
What are some of the other projects you got coming? First of all, when can we see that project or that series of projects?
That is something that I've been on it for 3 or 4 years. We keep going back and forth to New Zealand and trying to find a way to make the budget work. But that's, you know, that wants to be Harry Potter and Twilight, and it wants to be a franchise for that tween audience. It's fantasy, it's adventure, it's heartfelt, it's a beautiful series of books that we're hoping to get off the ground. The stuff I'm in the middle of now, I just finished shooting Falling Skies, which is on TNT, Spielberg's sort of post-apocalyptic show that Noah Wiley stars in.
You also worked with him on the Librarian movies as well.
Yes.
A little Indiana Jones feel, so you've got that going for you.
Yeah, I love. And actually, we're talking about another series of those.
Are we going to see more Librarians?
Yeah, I think those are great. Have you ever seen those movies?
I have. I've seen them all. Well, I'm a huge. The other podcast I'm on is the IndieCast. So it's an Indiana Jones podcast. So anything that's even close to that genre, we love.
Well, Noah always describes the Librarian as his role in the Librarian as Indiana Jones if played by Don Knotts.
That's a perfect way to describe it, too.
Yeah,
and the great Bob Newhart is on there.
Oh, the wonderful Bob Newhart.
Oh, you've got a chance to work with some of the legends.
That show had, it was Noah Wiley, Bob Newhart, Jane Curtin, and Olympia Dukakis. Those are the four regulars on the Librarian shows.
How great is that?
I know. Just bizarre. I'm so lucky.
That's what I say. You know, people might think of you as Riker, but man, you've just turned this into this amazing career. And that's kind of what I was referring to earlier, is that's an option that's available for actors today to do these kind of things. But I think you've got the chops to be able to pull that off. And I think you were able to get a lot of that by working with some of the heavyweights. So that's amazing. What are some of the other projects you've got coming up?
I go to work as soon as we get off the phone.
I was going to say, we interrupted you from directing today. What are you heading out to?
I was editing yesterday on Falling Skies. Today I started a series called Switched at Birth, which is an ABC family show. Then I go back to NCIS LA, hoping to get another Castle in this season.
That's right, the Castle episode, the Star Trek-themed Castle episode you did.
Oh, that was fabulous. Nathan Fillion's sort of a member of the... And Stanikotic from The Librarian.
Yep.
See, the world is very small.
It's a very small world in Hollywood. Any more Castles coming? You said you've got another Castle coming up?
I don't. I'm waiting to hear. There's a couple of slots left, and I'm hoping to get back on at the end of this season.
Okay, so hopefully another Castle, hopefully another Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
You got it, man.
Coming up. This would be great. So how can fans find out more about you? Websites, appearances, projects?
I keep them posted on my... on my Twitter feed, on Jonathan S. Frakes. And that's it. I don't really have a Facebook. They can follow you. You obviously know what the hell's going on.
You keep me posted. I'll keep them posted.
Fair enough.
Well, I'll be your marketing agent here. Well, we're looking forward to all these projects. I'd love, you know, we'd all love to see you in the Star Trek universe again, hopefully maybe a cameo in a J.J. Abrams film or J.J. Abrams produced film.
I wonder
film.
If he'll ever, if he'll let the Next Gen.
It's in the same universe.
The it is in the same universe, and I think certainly the opportunity's there. I'd be very curious to see.
Yeah. No conversations about that. Has anybody hinted? Maybe a couple of cameos? We see Nimoy popping up all the time.
Well, yeah, we always hint, and we always hope. So we'll see what happens.
Keep us posted. We'll let people know on Comic Book Central. So, well, we hope to see you in that universe, the Marvel universe, or even in that little independent universe that you're longing to, the cigarette-smoking individuals in France. So, Jonathan Frakes, thank you so much for taking the time to join us here on Comic Book Central today.
The pleasure's mine. Well done, man.
See, Jonathan, I told you Marina knew you were Captain America. I wonder what the crew did have to say about Jonathan in the red, white, and blue tights. Oh, well, another conversation for another day. Big thanks again to Marina Sirtis and Jonathan Frakes for joining me on the show. As I mentioned earlier, the interview with Marina was recorded at the Steel City Con in Monroeville, Pennsylvania. The next show is coming up April 11th through the 14th. This time around, you guessed it, special guest Jonathan Frakes will be attending. So go meet him, talk Trek, talk Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., get your Riker action figure signed. I highly recommend it. To find out more, check out steelcitycon.com. And for the latest on Marina or Jonathan, check out their Twitter pages. For Marina, it's at @Marina_Sirtis. And for Jonathan, it's at @JonathanSFrakes. Next week on Comic Book Central, hey, since we're talking Thor crossovers on S.H.I.E.L.D., what do you say we chat with someone from the realm of Asgard? Special guest Jamie Alexander, the Asgardian warrior Lady Sif, will be here to talk about her role in the Marvel Universe. She is an incredible woman, and she recently did something quite unique to help out some amazing kids. We'll talk about that. Trust me, you don't want to miss this episode. And be sure to check out all the episodes of Comic Book Central. Stan Lee, the Superman 75th celebration with folks from Superman the Movie, Smallville, Lois and Clark. They're all online. ComicBookCentral.net or subscribe on iTunes. Post a review. I want to know what you think of the show. And thanks to everybody for getting the word out. Facebook Nation, like and share the Facebook page at facebook.com/ComicBookCentralNetwork. Retweet me on the Twitter at ComicBookCTRL. And be sure to drop me a line, joe@ComicBookCentral.net. Well, that's it for today, Trekkers, Trekkies, comic book fans, everyone out there on the interwebby. Thanks for checking in. Next week, Jamie Alexander will cross the Rainbow Bridge of Asgard to talk about Thor. Until then, keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the Lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Unported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
No way.
Yeah.